If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
I can run from a deal real quickly, just in a few moments, just looking at the underwriting.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Hey, Rick, welcome to the show.
What's up, Sam? Excited to be here.
Man, it's great to have you on. It's great to have you on both as a friend and colleague in the business. So we already obviously know each other before the podcast, but our listeners may not. Do you mind giving us just your quick bio?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Rick Martin. I run Fortress Federation, and we're a multifamily company that focuses mainly in the Southeast and as well as Texas. We got units in both of those areas, and we kind of stick to that. Started out, like most people, as a single family investor, and enjoyed it, did well with it, but ran into some difficulties and just decided, okay, I got to do something new. And that's when I kind of turned the page to multifamily.
Gotcha. That's cool. Now, have you always been a real estate investor?
Yeah, since I was about 3 months old is when I picked up now. Dating back to where I sort of, I'd gotten out of college and was doing, kind of chasing my dream of a musician, but was able to buy my first house. And I couldn't be a starving artist forever. So I made a career change, and that took me out of that house, and that house became a rental. And that's when the light bulb went off, and I was collecting checks and thought, okay, I'm gonna start doing this regularly.
Wow. That's super cool. I mean, it's a very natural entrance into the real estate game, if you will. What the same questions I ask everybody, and maybe we kind of started this because I got a little off kilter here, but the same question to ask everybody who comes on is, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there? So it sounds like we got, the where did you start, but where are you now?
I could sort of embellish upon what I already said. Yeah, I think when I had that first single family, had some great returns going on, but ran into some few crazy tenants that started to kind of, give me the idea that maybe I don't want to do this full time. I'll be a full time manager, a property manager, but I knew nothing else at the time. So I started down the coast. I invested in Nevada, I think was my first out of state investment. That was prior to the crash. So that took some interesting turns. Did some investing in Palm Desert, California, as well as LA, because I lived in LA. And then I eventually ended up in the Midwest. And it was then that I had three projects going on. I had a buy and hold, I had a fourplex, and I had a flip going on. And I thought by the end of these three projects, I'm going to have a nice little lump sum that I can parlay into other properties, just the way I've done it before. But with the fourplex, my contractor just kind of jumped the ship. He was checking off the list of the statement of work, doing just fine. But it was time for him to buy some appliances, and that's where he just kind of went dark on me. It was a lesson learned. I think I probably paid him too much at that point. Like the appliances had not yet been delivered, and I had the impression that they were going to be. And then, so in a sense, he kind of like stole those appliances. I don't know whatever happened, but I tried to chase the guy down, never found him, had to switch there. So that, took some bite out of those returns. I recovered. And then with the flip, things were going very slowly with that contractor. I'm trying to crack the whip from, 2,000 miles away, and not much was getting done, but it was finally coming together. And then right at the end, of course, the sewer line went. It was older, it's an older place. So again, big bite out of the returns. And with the buy and hold, all of a sudden those tenants, I'm not sure what happened. They may have been subletting, God knows, but they went from being good tenants to having like a little cockroach farm in there. And the turn on that became so expensive that I think I ended up selling the place and getting like 4%. And so that was the time where I was like, okay, something's got to change. And I think I heard a podcast about multifamily. So I was going to, rather than me and my wife were talking about buying a new place, but we thought, well, let's not take this chunk of money and sink it into an expensive house. Let's go buy an apartment. I mean, I told her all about it. She was on board, but it was easier said than done. And a lot of the places I was looking at where the numbers made sense were kind of, they just weren't, they're in rough areas. And so I thought I was going to maybe team up with someone, joint venture, but I was continuing to educate and continuing to learn about this business. And I heard a term about syndication. You know, that was kind of the path I was on, but I was growing impatient. So I ended up, learning about a few different operators and just investing passively in a few deals. And that was kind of nice because now I could see, all right, I can do my own active stuff, but I can kind of spread myself around the country, which I did. You know, I was in Ohio, I was in Texas, I was in Florida, and I was, you know, I was collecting rent, I was collecting checks. So it wasn't so bad. I was earning while I was learning. And eventually, you know, I just established some great relationships with some operators and became a co-sponsor myself. And that was, you know, in the last couple of years, and it's going great.
So do you still own single family properties?
I have one fourplex.
What market is that in?
That's it. That is the fourplex I mentioned. It's in Indianapolis.
I got you.
And that's it. I sold off everything over the last several years. You know, the flips would come and go, but buy and hold in single family is pretty much off the table right now for me.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. And so you're based, you said 2,000 miles away, so you're based in Los Angeles.
I'm in, yeah, Redondo Beach, California.
Right. Okay. That's fascinating. And so then you found partners in Ohio, Texas, and Florida that you passively invested in or actively invested in? I just want to make sure I understood that, if I didn't hear it correctly.
Yeah, well, one of them I actually was a KP on, which actually gave me some loan experience pretty early on because I was kind of looking down the road. I thought, I'm going to want to bring something to the table. I'm going to want to be able to get in and whether it's bringing on net worth or bringing some risk capital or bringing loan experience, you know, there are different ways you could get into the deal. And I didn't want anything to hold me back. You know, I didn't want to get to the point where, you know, maybe I could joint venture on a building and say, well, you don't have the loan experience. You have to bring someone else in. But as I continued to educate and network, I met some great people down in the Southeast, specifically in the Carolinas, and also met some people that operate in Florida and Georgia. And then I have a real good relationship in Texas. And we're like, you know, we're becoming like friends, you know, we know and trust each other. And I have supreme confidence in their ability to execute business plans, you know, so I don't have to go through that strenuous activity of vetting the operator. It still happens, you know, I'll get deals that will come my way and they'll ask me if I want to come on board, but that's tricky. You know, there's only so much time you put these deals in front of your investors and you really have to know these people inside and out. So when someone that I know and I know how they operate comes to me, it just takes so much off the plate. Like, okay, good. The operators are solid. Now, how about the market? How about the deal?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point you made there. And maybe we can rewind the tape a bit. You said something to the effect of the KP. You wanted to have experience as a KP. What is a KP?
Key principal. It's not like your general partner. You're not one of the managers on the deal, but you are, you're either bringing net worth or you're bringing loan experience to the deal. You're not a limited partner. You're not a general partner, but you're a key principal. Yeah, you're basically bringing one of those elements to the table.
Right. And so then that means that as part of the deal, your name goes down as one of the members of the team. And so then that gives you what you called loan experience.
Yeah, you're actually signing on the loan.
Right.
In that case, it was a Fannie Freddie, I can't remember which it was, Fannie or Freddie loan, but it gives you that agency debt experience.
Right, which you need in the future then. That's a chip you may cash in the future that says, yes, I have experience with these types of loans because they require that. Is that right?
Exactly. It's just one more quiver, you know, one more thing to put in your tool belt.
Right. No, I think that's brilliant. That's brilliant. And that's I think that's something people who are looking to scale maybe don't think about. Because early on, you want to take down a deal and do something big, make the game-changing transaction. But for you, you were steadily putting the pieces in place so that you could do that in the future if the opportunity arose.
Yeah. You know, syndication, it's simple, but it's complex, you know, and there's so many hats to wear. And I wasn't thinking along those lines. You know, all I wanted to do was get me and my family set up, have some cash flow coming in. And then it just became larger. You know, I saw like, okay, wow, you're really part of a business. You're part of the team. So I started looking at different ways to get involved. And there are many different ways. You know, I mentioned you could bring risk capital. You could bring your loan experience. You could bring your net worth. But really at the end of the day, what I want is to be involved in acquisitions. I love doing the market, sub-market analysis. I like co-underwriting the deal. And really, I mean, my focus has become educating investors and bringing investors on board and raising the equity. So it takes a while. You know, I think some people, they'll join a mentorship and boom, they're off to the races. But there are other ways, and it's evolution. And you start to learn all the different areas and see where you're going to bring, you know, value to the table. And then, you know, it becomes something bigger. Like I say, it was just about cash flow. But when you're like affecting, you know, like we had 167 unit down in Augusta, Georgia, you walk those units and you see, oh, okay, you got young children here doing their Zoom calls for school. You see people, you see families in action. You realize, okay, you know, we got to make this right for these people as well as make it right for our investors. So it really does become a much larger responsibility, but that's kind of what makes it exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is more, this business is much more, multifamily is much more than spreadsheets.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really right. Cool. I think one of the things, or I did want to ask you about this, when you said you bring risk capital to the table, can you define that for us?
You know, earnest money, basically. It's no different than when you're out there with your spouse and you're going to buy a house, you got to put down some money, right? And it's risk capital. And then you go through a due diligence period and make sure that everything checks out. But there is risk. Back when COVID hit, we had money in a deal down in Bradenton, and it was scary, man. Money was going hard because the market was so competitive and is now becoming competitive again. And people were losing their risk capital left and right. And I had an opportunity to put some risk capital down on a deal in Irvington, Texas. And I'm really relieved I didn't do that because I would have lost it. And it would have been a pretty healthy chunk of money. You know, I commend those people that forewent, I don't know if that's a word, forewent their risk. Is it, Sam? I don't know.
Hey, man, this is your story. I don't care.
Okay. I have
my forego in it.
I have my own vocabulary. You'll find
it,
that.
It works. All good.
All right. Okay, man. I do. No, I appreciate and respect those guys that took a hit for their investors, basically. You know, COVID, we didn't know what was going to happen, right? Now, you know, things are becoming clearer. But back then, everybody was scared, like, oh, my God, what's happening? And, you know, the lenders were doing what they were doing. People pulled out of deals because they didn't want to lose their investors' money. And with it, they lost, you know, $200,000 out of the pocket. And that's what can happen with risk capital.
Gotcha. So that's interesting. Why are you now currently confident that you would have lost your risk capital in the Irvington deal?
Because they did. They pulled out of that deal, but the money went hard and they didn't get it back.
Yikes. I've heard, and I don't have any firsthand experience. If you're listening to this, tell me, you know, you can get on Facebook or LinkedIn and tell me I'm completely wrong, but I've heard certain big names in the industry say there's no such thing as hard money and that there's always a way out. But I don't know that that's actually, you know, I don't know anybody that's seen that play out in person.
I've known several people who have lost the risk capital.
Right.
And there, I think there are different rules. You know, some money goes harder than others, but yeah, I can count three people just off the top of my head who lost significant amount of money back when COVID hit, and good operators, you know, and, like I say, I respect them and I think they should be telling their investors they lost that money for them. You know, they put their neck out, and that's what people have to realize. You know, there is risk being a general partner.
They lose the deal because they couldn't get it funded?
Yeah, basically they could have gotten it funded, but the amount of reserves just made the deal no longer made sense. Because if you recall, they were requiring like 18 months of reserves at that time, and the seller wasn't budging. because all the sellers at that time were like, oh man, I got to get rid of this property now. So that, I think that's what happened to a lot of people. The reserves really just killed the returns. I think some people got creative, you know, they took some of their CapEx money and kind of helped, you know, borrowed from that. You know, there were ways around it, but I think a lot of people were scrambling at that time. And so, yeah, a few got burnt, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. But you're right. There is risk on the general partnership side that, you know, especially when you're plunking down large sums of money that, you know, you don't get the deal done, and then it could cost you heftily. Let's talk, you made a point earlier about vetting the operator and how that's part of your strategy has been to, the vetting of the operator is now done. And so now you can focus more on the deal and market analysis. Why is that important?
Well, it's just trust. I mean, if I'm a co-sponsor, I'm not operating the deal, right? And I'm putting not only my own money into this deal, but I'm putting my investors' money into the deal. And if I'm not operating, how can I know that they're going to operate and they're going to execute on their game plan? And really, I've not taken a deal where I just jumped in and I say, ah, it seems like a nice guy. The deals that I've done, I've known these people for a while. I've seen how they've run their ship. I see how they underwrite. I can run from a deal real quickly, just in a few moments, just looking at the underwriting, see where it's aggressive. And so I begin there. And see how realistic they are. People talk about track records, and yeah, if you have track record, it's nice, but I have one group that I work with, and they have a bit of a track record, but they are just so passionate and committed and smart, and just the way they're running their ship, I have zero doubt that they execute on what they say they'll execute on. And so far they have, and they're doing better. You know, all the deals that I'm involved in, I'm happy to say, are actually beating projections. And it just feels nice when you can send out that monthly notice. Hey people, you know, just an update. Yeah. It's a pleasant surprise for them. They just want to know, investors want to know, okay, hey, I'm not going to lose my money. Right. And they would like to at least, you know, meet the projections, but when you're beating them, that makes them feel pretty nice inside.
I think it makes us all feel nice inside. It's like, hey, wait, not only does this model working, but it's doing better than what we said it would. So as a deal sponsor, that certainly is it's a good feeling and a fun email to send out.
It is. And that's the beauty of conservative underwriting, you know? And you have to kind of impress that upon the investor, kind of enlighten them, like, what does conservative underwriting mean? They hear that term a lot.
Right.
But when you actually show them, you know, not line by line, but all the key levers, like why, you know, coming in a little lower than this, it may not look so sexy right now, but we're protecting your money. And trust me, you know, when this deal starts running and you start getting the actual statements back, you're going to be pleasantly surprised.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's always good to under promise and over deliver, I think.
Absolutely.
And that for me has been a struggle. I'll be honest with you. It's been a struggle when you're underwriting a deal and you go, gosh, I can dumb this down to the point to where the returns are no longer, you know, amazing. It's now just like it's an average everyday deal. And I've struggled somewhat to sell those just because you go, well, look, you know, I'm making sure that we set the bar for returns to be very achievable versus, you know, if we do X, Y, and Z, it's going to be a home run. But I also find when that happens that the deal becomes just an everyday average deal and harder to move. How do you overcome that?
Absolutely. Well, unfortunately, I think you have to have good relationships at the right time, because when I think about these deals that I was just thinking about and telling you about, each one of them was off market, and each one of them was bought through a relationship. So you didn't have multiple buyers coming in, because when you have that situation, when you got multiple buyers coming, of course, someone's going to out underwrite you. You know, they're going to do what they need to do to be more competitive than you and come in at a better price, and you're out. And that's what we do, right? We look at so many deals. We underwrite a lot of deals. We submit our LOIs, and then we're told no. And I think, And it's tough, man. It's tough. I mean, that's what I was talking about. That's why I started investing passively a long time ago, because I just wanted to get in. I couldn't get a deal to pencil, mm-hmm. Because everything I conservatively underwrote, you know, that's the way I was trained. That's the way we should all be trained. But there's someone out there who's, you know, tweaking those rent growth a little bit more than they should, or they're not really, you know, the exit cap's about the same as what their going in prevailing cap is. And yeah, you're going to get outdone. And I know that feeling, man. I feel it all the time. I'll look at a deal come in my inbox and I'll be like, I'm not even going to bother. You know, I just know that's not, I'm not going to be able to compete with them.
Right. Right. No, absolutely. I think your point there, and at some other point, maybe or some other show, we'll have you come back on and we'll do just a whole episode on what it looks like to conservatively underwrite.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because I think that's something, one, that people, especially passive investors, don't necessarily know what to look for in that. And I think maybe you're talking about reversion cap rates and things like that, if you're not trained to look for that, maybe you'll overlook it. And it might be the one thing that makes the deal look incredibly better than what it should.
Absolutely. That's why if you're a passive investor and you get that deal with those nice, you know, healthy returns, just please, you know, take a deeper look under the cover, and you want to make sure what's going on there. You got to have some guidance in that respect.
Not all deals with excellent returns are bad deals.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah,
they do exist, but you just got to make sure that the underwriting and due diligence has been done to the point to where it can support those assumptions that are being made. I can think of one deal I reviewed recently where they had like an 8 or 10% rent bump in the first year. And I just looked at it and I was like, yeah, no, I don't think so.
Yeah. Those are tough, you know, because in you're executing your business plan, you're raising rents, that rent growth is going to be forced the first couple of years, right? Sure. And it's going to look a little scary. So you're going to offset that with a little economic vacancy or some concessions, because that's going to happen, right? And your current tenants who are paying below rents and were happy with that situation, they're going to move on.
Right.
I tend to look at the organic rent growth that happens, you know, year three and beyond. And then, yeah, if you have the high rent growth during the business, during the renovation, you just want to make sure that it's being offset with some vacancy. But yeah, if you're looking at, you know, 4 or 5% rent growth from year three on, that's a little ambitious. You know, you should be looking in the twos, maybe. Mm-hmm. Two, yeah, maybe even three right now with COVID, just stretching it, right? I mean, that's how I look at it anyway.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Rick, is there anything else we should talk about before we jump here into the final four?
I think I've talked a lot. I think we should, let's do the final four.
Put an end to this. No, man, absolutely. Here it is. Here's the final four. Final four questions are, one, what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
I would say, there's a lot, but I would say don't fall in love with a deal no matter how far down the river you are. I mean, it's tough. When you're doing all the numbers and you're doing all the due diligence, you're flying out to a property and you feel like this deal is, we got this deal. You're not thinking you're going to get out of this deal. And then something comes up in due diligence. Maybe they reported the square footage way less than really what it was, or just there's just something that it's a major red flag and you got to walk away. Like they say, no deal is better than a bad deal. And it can be tough. You're months into this thing and you gotta walk away. It's difficult. I would say just don't fall in love with any deal.
I think you're the first person that's given that piece of advice on this show. And I really appreciate that. I think that's really important. It was somebody, it was Dave. Anyway, I can't remember his last name right off the top of my head, but he came on as a 1031 exchange guy. And he said, look, no deal you've ever done will or the deal you never did won't bankrupt you. So, in keeping with that, like it's the deal you shouldn't have done. That's the one that will, that's the one that'll sink the ship. So,
yeah,
that's really good advice for you for an aspiring investor. Number two is, when it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you are doing to stay on top of your game?
If I had to say, I guess it's sort of my health routine lately, my morning routine for sure. If I can get up and get a surf in, man, that just makes my day awesome. Like I don't need to meditate because I meditate out there. But really, and speaking of meditating, maybe I'll backtrack a little bit and I'll just say staying present. And no matter what I'm doing, whether if I'm with my kids, be present with my kids. If I'm doing real estate, be present with my real estate. If I'm out surfing, be present with surfing, because that's really what meditation is, right? It's being present. And I feel like you're so much more laser focused when you're present. And I've not always been the best at that, but I'm working on it. I think it's helping me be more efficient in life.
Yeah, that's a good word too. Yeah, being present, that's a tough one, especially in today's age. It's like, man, you know, even while we're sitting here having this conversation, all of a sudden there's a phone buzzing in my pocket. There's a, you know, something blinking on the screen behind me. It's like, oh my gosh, world, leave me alone. I'm just trying to talk to Rick, for goodness sake. So yeah, focusing in, man.
I heard some good advice also. Before you do anything in the day, before you turn on your phone, before you check your email or social media, just get present with yourself. Just tune in to you before you plug into the rest of the world.
That's a good word. That's a good word. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
You know, we used to do some work with the homeless, really on the front lines. And that was great. And then I've done some pro bono for some children that are orphaned around the world. And try to continue to do that when the opportunity comes up. But right now, I just have a soft spot in my heart for kids that don't have a family. So that's kind of where my focus is.
What does that mean?
Just choosing the right charity. You know, you have to sort of vet these charities. You got to make sure where your money's going. With the ones I mentioned before, the homeless and they're actually third world orphans. I actually have relationships with the people that run those organizations, so I know them. Mm. It's kind of like the operators, you know, that I know with syndications. Yeah. I feel the same way. I have to vet charities before I plunk money. I just want to make sure it's going to where I want it to go.
Right. No, that's super cool. That's super cool. Yeah. Love that. Love that. Rick, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
You can go to my website at www.fortressfederation.com. You can get me at rick@fortressfederation.com. And on my website, I got a ebook. It's like the quick start guide to investing in syndications. I think you'll find it helpful, kind of get you up and running quickly. And of course, you can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook and all the rest.
Right. That's great. Rick, thanks so much for your time today. I certainly appreciate it.
Right on, Sam. Thanks for having me, man. Real pleasure.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.